Kiss in the morning, kiss at night. Give gold stars. Make the positive argument. Take driving lessons. I'd spent the month of September thinking about possessions. Now, although I did believe that the stuff of life was more important than some people conceded, I was ready to turn to something far more significant. My marriage. A strong marriage is associated with happiness for two reasons. First, because people who are already happy make better dates and easier spouses, they get married and stay married more easily than do unhappy people. Both men and women are attracted to happy partners. At the same time, marriage itself brings happiness because support and companionship are such important elements to a happy life. To be happy, we need more than casual acquaintances. We need intimate relationships of mutual understanding, love, and support. Most marriages exhibit homogamy. That is, partners tend to resemble each other in matters such as age, education, ethnicity, level of attractiveness, and political ideology. And over time, as they influence each other, knowingly or not, spouses become even more alike. Also, in a phenomenon called health concordance, partners' behaviors tend to merge as they pick up health habits from each other related to eating, exercising, smoking, drinking, and visiting doctors. Sometimes for the better. If one spouse quits smoking, the other is 67% less likely to continue. Sometimes for the worse. Married couples are 3 times more likely both to be obese. It's even true that couples who didn't particularly resemble each other when first married come to resemble each other after 25 years of marriage, and those who look the most alike report the happiest marriages. My relationship with Jamie was one of the most significant factors in my happiness at home. In a sense, Jamie was my home. Home was wherever we were together. I wanted to foster a tender, romantic, lighthearted atmosphere between us, and I wanted Jamie to be happy. And I knew that when I was happier, he was happier, both because he caught that happiness from me, spouses influence each other's happiness levels, and because he worried if I seemed unhappy. Jamie and I met in law school. I still remember the first time I saw him walk into the library. A shock ran through me. He was wearing a rose-colored Patagonia pullover, which I still have. I walked over to a friend and whispered casually, "Who is that guy?" Our law school was small, and our social circles started to overlap. One night, we sat next to each other at a dinner party. Then there was that afternoon we ran into each other on the law school staircase in front of the stained glass windows. But he had a girlfriend, and I had a boyfriend. Then he broke up with his girlfriend. Since our school was small, the news spread fast. A week later, I broke up with my boyfriend. It happened in the morning, and I went out into the courtyard and made a general announcement of the breakup to a bunch of friends to see what Jamie's reaction would be. No reaction. I thought, maybe I misread this situation. Had I imagined what I thought was between us? After all, the two of us had never talked about anything important, certainly not about us. We'd never spent any time alone, only in chaperoned groups, except once when he'd asked me to breakfast at the Copper Kitchen Diner before our corporations class, an occasion so thrilling to me in prospect that I slept only a few hours the night before, and neither of us had ever made even the smallest romantic overtures toward the other. But the afternoon of my breakup, he told me he was going to walk to get a soda, and did I want to come? I did. We walked to the store, then back to the law school, and sat on a bench beneath some blooming magnolia trees. He started to say something, then took my hand. This was the first time we ever touched. At that moment, if he'd asked me to marry him, it would have seemed perfectly natural, and I might well have said yes. We did get engaged several months later. Now, so many years later, is it the same? Yes and no. Yes, because I still love him passionately and more deeply, because I know him so much better. No, because he pervades my entire life, so now sometimes it's hard to see him. Married people are so intertwined, so interdependent, that it's hard to maintain that sense of wonder and excitement. If I've learned one thing from my happiness project, It's that if I want my life to be a certain way, I must be that way myself. If I want my marriage to be tender and romantic, I must be tender and romantic. Am I tender and romantic? Am I appreciative, thoughtful, forbearing, fun-loving? Or do I march around the apartment snapping out reminders and orders? Am I quick to feel annoyed or aggrieved? Do I make the mean face? When Jamie and I first met, I honestly wondered whether it would ever be possible for me to read when we were sitting in a room together. I found it so hard to concentrate that I couldn't make sense of anything more complicated than the newspaper. Now I sometimes find it hard to tear myself away from my work and email to hold up my end of a marital conversation. For my first happiness project, I'd followed several resolutions related to love and marriage, such as quit nagging, don't expect praise or appreciation, fight right, and give proofs of love. Jamie's response has been one of my happiness project's most gratifying results. Jamie was and remains emphatically uninterested in crafting his own resolutions, debating the finer points of happiness philosophy, or discussing anyone's mood. But he has changed. He used to have a tendency to throw in a few sarcastic comments from time to time, or to tease with a harsh edge, and he could be a bit of a killjoy. Not too often, but sometimes. And now he does this far less often. He curbed his habit of pestering me, my word for the way he'd sometimes jokingly do things to drive me crazy, just to see me get hopping mad. I'd worked hard to quit nagging, and now he does more tasks without prompting. His priorities don't reflect my priorities, but my priorities don't reflect his priorities. I think holiday cards are important. He thinks air conditioning repair is important. He'd become more thoughtful, more outwardly loving, and more likely to put away the suitcase. I'd tried to stop keeping score. As Saint Therese observed, when one loves, one does not calculate. And he'd done the same. I still got annoyed sometimes, actually frequently, but I handled it better, usually. One morning Jamie said, "Would you go get our mortgage documents?" "From where?" I asked blankly. "I don't know, from the files." "What files?" "Don't we have a file called mortgage?" "Do we? You tell me." I felt irritated when Jamie talked about what we did, when in fact it was all me. "We put up the decorations last week," he'd say, or "we mailed that check last week." "Come on," he said impatiently, "where is it?" For a moment, I was tempted to play out this argument, to declaim about why this we bothered me, why he needed to be able to locate things, why it shouldn't always be my responsibility, but I caught myself. Did I really want to have this argument? In fact, although it was a pain, I actually preferred to be in charge of important papers. "Okay," I sighed, "I'll track them down." "Thanks," he said. I was struck by a truth that I'd learned to appreciate during my first happiness project, one important enough to rocket to the status of my sixth splendid truth. The only person I can change is myself. Although I'm sometimes tempted to hand Jamie a long list of all the, to my mind, quite reasonable changes he should make to boost my happiness, the fact is, I can write that list only for myself. Nevertheless, when I changed, our relationship changed, and Jamie changed. I was extremely fortunate, I knew, in my husband. Jamie did change in ways that made our marriage happier, but in any event, the changes contemplated were small and manageable compared to the huge, difficult issues that many other couples face. Nevertheless, as in all things happiness-related, even though I was already pretty happy in my marriage, striving for more happiness was a worthwhile aim. For one thing, I wanted to do more to appreciate this stage of life with Jamie. We'd been married 16 years, so we were in the thick of middle marriage. Children at home, mid-career, home ownership, milestone birthdays. I wanted to make sure that this time didn't slip away unremarked. Each period of life has its own atmosphere, its own flavor. Yet in the past, I'd failed to appreciate each stage as it was unfolding. I thought back to our first years together. There had been that crazy, intense period when we were newly engaged, and I was a third-year law student working all the time on the law journal, and he was an overworked first-year associate in a law firm, and we were always taking the train between New Haven and New York. And then we'd been newly married in our first apartment, furnished with wedding gifts and hand-me-down furniture from my father-in-law's old office. I remember being annoyed when a friend walked into the apartment and remarked, "I see what you mean about the office furniture." No children yet. How had Jamie and I spent our weekends, just the two of us? What did we do with our long evenings of leisure? I have no recollection. At the time, I'd never stopped to notice the particular quality of that time, though a few clear memories do blaze out from the dim muddle of days. I remember one morning in our first apartment when Jamie woke me up to see a particularly beautiful sunrise, and one morning in our second apartment when we woke to see snow drifting picturesquely through the cracks in the ceiling. Then there was our time as new parents. I remember how, in the springtime when Eliza was just a few months old, I'd walk to Jamie's office with her and the baby Bjorn, and the three of us would walk back home together. Eliza was so tiny that I could carry her for miles without difficulty. I remember how different it felt for Jamie and me suddenly to be parents out with our child, instead of just the two of us. To me, Jamie looks exactly the way he's always looked. So when the girls and I pulled out some old photo albums, I was surprised to see how jet black his hair used to be. I'd forgotten about that pair of glasses he wore for so many years. And when had he gotten rid of that green t-shirt that I'd loved? For this happiness project, I wanted more appreciation, more tenderness, more cooperation, more fun with Jamie. I wanted to rise above the trivial complaints and petty annoyances that could drag down our relationship. This is a special challenge in marriage because studies show that married people actually treat each other with less civility than they show to other people. Whether while talking casually or working on a task, people were less courteous and tactful with a spouse than with a person they didn't know well. These findings didn't surprise me, but they did reinforce my determination to treat Jamie, the love of my life, with more consideration. I would never snap at a friend, "Do we have to talk about this right now?" or "Can't you just do it?" I wanted to stop speaking that way to Jamie. I had high expectations for my marriage, which I learned was a good thing. A study led by the psychologist Donald Baucom showed that husbands and wives who have reasonably high standards for romance, passion, and respect tend to have marriages that reflect those values. Those with lower expectations often get what they expect. Couples who don't tolerate much bad behavior from each other at the beginning of a relationship are happier in that relationship later. I wanted to expect more for myself in my marriage. Kiss in the morning, kiss at night. Experts advise parents to establish routines and rituals to provide children with a feeling of predictability, order, and connection. But adults crave these things too. I resolved to make a ritual to kiss in the morning, kiss at night. Every morning, every night, I would kiss Jamie. No surprise, research establishes that kissing boosts feelings of intimacy, eases stress, and encourages bonding. Couples feel more connected and warmer when they touch and kiss frequently. Kissing is a very popular activity. Kissing between romantic or sexual partners is practiced in more than 90% of cultures. I considered the day's different kissing opportunities. Every morning, I wake up at 6 a.m., well before Jamie does, so I started to kiss him before I got out of bed. Usually, his face is buried in the pillow, so I kiss his shoulder. Then, so he'd get a kiss when he was actually awake, I kissed him before he left for work. I also gave him a proper welcome home kiss. Not just an absent-minded wave from across the room, as had been my habit. Sometimes this kiss was just a quick exchange, but sometimes it turned into a real, lingering embrace. Jamie has always been good about kissing goodnight at bedtime, but I made sure that we never skipped a kiss. Yes, it felt a bit preposterous to have a kissing schedule, but I reminded myself, if something's important to me, I should make time for it, even if that means timing kisses with the regularity of toothbrushing. I kissed Eliza and Eleanor several times each day, and I wanted lots of kisses with Jamie, too. Kissing at these times had the added benefit of ensuring that Jamie and I actually paid attention to each other as we came and went from home. It was all too easy to stay absorbed in our own concerns as we rushed through the apartment. By acting more loving, I made myself feel loving, and at the same time, made Jamie feel more loved. Kissing also helped me to recall that silence is sometimes more comforting than conversation. One evening, Jamie seemed preoccupied, and I was ready to launch into questions like, "What's on your mind? Is everything okay? You seem distracted." Then I realized, actually, Jamie really doesn't like that kind of talk, and instead I gave him a long kiss. That seemed to cheer him up. Sometimes words only diminish what I want to convey. Give gold stars. Many people are fascinated by the happiness differences between men and women. For the most part, I don't focus on these differences because I think it obscures the differences among individuals. When I focus on the way men or husbands generally behave, I start to lump Jamie along with half of humanity. I find myself feeling angry or annoyed with Jamie for things he hasn't even done. Some men don't make the bed or take out the garbage, but Jamie does. However, some research did shed a helpful light on our relationship. Researcher Terry Arbuck, director of the Early Years of Marriage Project, started in 1986, so by now it includes the middle years too, concluded that after the first years of marriage, a difference arises in how men and women perceive relationship talk. Wives find relationship talk reassuring because it makes them feel closer to their husbands. Husbands find relationship talk upsetting because they associate it with marital problems and blame, and they often interpret such talk as nagging. This was certainly true for Jamie. Like many longtime couples, Jamie and I had developed some private catchphrases, and for years, we joked about, "Want to get a cup of coffee?" Early on, I'd asked Jamie this innocent question, and he'd immediately assumed a wary, hunted look. Apparently, in some earlier relationship, getting a cup of coffee had always led to unpleasant relationship talk. So I'd skip the relationship talk. On the other hand, reading Orbuck's conclusions about the importance of affective affirmations prompted me to adopt the resolution to give gold stars. For my first happiness project, I'd made the resolution, don't expect praise or appreciation. Oh, how I yearn for applause and recognition. I always want those gold stars stuck on my homework, but Jamie doesn't often hand them out. I wished he'd tell me I was brilliant or beautiful. I wish he'd praise me for finding those mortgage papers or for organizing the family schedule for the week. But while Jamie has many wonderful qualities, and I love him with all my heart, he doesn't hand out gold stars. Not even the occasional, "Good thing you wrote down that phone number," or "You were right, we do need umbrellas." To be fair, he also rarely criticizes me. He never says, "Why don't you ever suggest going to a movie or museum?" Or, "Hey, Miss Happiness Project, aren't you breaking a resolution right now?" I continually battle this craving to receive gold stars, and I've made progress, somewhat. Reading about Orbuck's research about affective affirmation, however, shifted my attention from my need for gold stars to Jamie's need for gold stars. Predictably, studies show that receiving a spouse's affective affirmation, psych speak for a spouse's actions or words to make the other spouse feel loved, appreciated, desired, and supported, is very important to the happiness of both husbands and wives. More surprisingly, gold stars are much more important to husbands than to wives. Why? Orbuck argues that husbands need more gold stars from their wives because women get much more positive support outside marriage. They want it from their husbands, yes, but they do have other sources. Family members, colleagues, friends of both genders, and even strangers give more frequent affirmations to women than to men. Men, by contrast, depend much more on their wives for reassurance and understanding. Men's relationships tend to be less intense and supportive than women's, and in fact, for empathy and intimacy, both men and women seek friendship with women. I knew I was Jamie's main source of affective affirmation. His friends and the guys in his office weren't handing out compliments or confiding secrets. If he wanted praise, or sympathy, or the chance to talk over a sensitive subject, he turned to me. A friend told me that she sat down at her computer one day to discover that her husband had changed her screensaver to read, "Be nice to Lloyd, today and every day." "I laughed for 5 minutes the first time I saw it," she told me. "It was a good reminder," I thought, and I resolved to give gold stars. Research shows that partners who make thoughtful efforts for each other are happier with their bond. Although it's not clear whether the consideration or the contentment comes first, they probably both feed into each other. St. Thérèse of Lisieux declared, "It isn't enough to love. We must prove it." What could I say and do to give gold stars? When something good happened to Jamie at work or elsewhere, I made a big fuss, and I shared the news with Jamie's parents and my parents. He's very modest about touting his accomplishments. Studies show that celebrating good news and showing the happiness you feel in your partner's accomplishments, small and large, strengthens a relationship. Being silently supportive isn't very effective. I thanked him when he tackled some chore, dealt with a tax form, assembled a piece of furniture, even if it was something he was supposed to do. And when Jamie solved a problem for me or gave me useful advice, I told him how helpful he'd been instead of taking him for granted. I said the words, "I love you," more often. Studies show that people are more apt to feel close to a family member who often expresses affection than one who rarely does. I tried to be helpful even when Jamie didn't ask for help. For example, Jamie never takes a pain reliever unless I actually hand him 2 pills with a glass of water. So when he said he had a headache, I went to get them. When I spoke to other people about Jamie, whether he was present or not, I said only good things. No more complaining or criticizing. When I saw a sweet photo opportunity with the girls, I emailed him pictures so he knew we were thinking of him. When he was traveling, I sent quick reports about nice little things that happened. If he asked, "Will you do me a favor?" I bit back my automatic response, a suspicious, "What's the favor?" Instead, I answered, "Of course." I tried to be cheerfully accommodating, whether he wanted to go to the gym, get some work done on the weekend, leave a party early, or change plans at the last minute, or if he kept asking the same question over and over without listening to my answer. Jamie loves to pack early for trips and to unpack the minute we get home. I'm never in such a hurry, but that work has to be done at some point, so I began to go along with his timing. When he called me, I made sure to sound pleased and engaged, not rushed or distracted. Also, I stopped reading my emails while talking to him on the phone. So rude. But I did it. Often. Jamie, not me, researched vacation spots, found interesting places around New York City to visit, and bought tickets to children's concerts, circuses, and shows. Instead of taking this for granted, as I'd done for years, I made an effort to mention how much I appreciated his planning. I drew up this list, and I tried to follow it. I often failed, but I tried. Jamie still had occasion to say, "Please don't clench your jaw at me," but I behaved better. This resolution also made me more attentive to Jamie's virtues, his magnanimity and generosity, his inexplicable knowledge about everything from hip-hop music to obscure political figures, his unerring good judgment, his crazy ability to remember people's names, faces, and backgrounds, his ability to engage with difficult people, his strength in leadership, his unwavering calm, his perpetual good humor, his ingenuity in the face of problems, his unfailing willingness to stop for snacks. Now, my heroic description of Jamie may sound unrealistic. I remember that at her toast at our rehearsal dinner, my sister Elizabeth began, "Jamie has become an important part of my life," and got a big laugh when she continued, "And while I don't see him as quite the Odyssean epic hero that Gretsch does, I do love him very much." I really believe in Jamie's epic qualities, and even if I do idealize him just a bit, that's a sign of strength in our marriage. Studies show that happy couples are much more likely to idealize each other, and by holding those positive perceptions, they help each other live up to them. In what's called the Michelangelo effect, because Michelangelo created beautiful figures out of marble blocks, when romantic partners expect the best in each other, they help each other attain those ideals. As the counterpart to giving Jamie more gold stars, I also tried to stop giving him black marks. I discovered, however, that I had an easier time saying nice things than biting back critical comments. I enjoyed saying thanks or what a great solution, but I found it hard to resist saying, haven't you done that yet? Or you're not being helpful? Or I can't believe you've given the girls so much ice cream. Worst of all, I continued to make that supposedly terrifying mean face that Jamie and the girls complained about. I wanted to cut back on these unpleasant exchanges because I knew that for a happy marriage, it's more helpful to have fewer negative experiences than to have more positive experiences. Although it wasn't always easy to give out gold stars or to swallow criticisms or to avoid making the mean face, neither I nor Jamie indulged in one very significant negative behavior: eye rolling. This common, seemingly unremarkable gesture is highly noxious. It's one of the clearest signs of problems in a relationship. Even when eye rolling is paired with smiles or laughter, it's a sign of contempt intended to make a partner feel unworthy and signals trouble. My mean face, while quite mean, luckily does not include eye rolling. Make the positive argument. I love Jamie passionately, but sometimes I fall into a spiral of criticism. He annoys me by not answering me when I speak to him, and that gets me thinking about how he also annoyed me by not mailing an important form, and so on. I discovered an excellent technique to combat this tendency. As a consequence of a psychological phenomenon that might be called argumentative reasoning, people are very skillful at arguing a particular case. When a person takes a position, he or she looks for evidence to support it, and then stops, satisfied. This mental process gives the illusion that a position is objective and well-justified. However, and this is the useful point, a person can often make the very opposite argument, just as easily. If I tell myself I'm a shy person, I marshal examples of my shyness. If I tell myself I'm an outgoing person, I remember times when I was outgoing. I'm able to argue both conclusions quite persuasively. To make use of this phenomenon, I resolved to make the positive argument, and it proved quite effective. When I caught myself thinking, Jamie isn't very thoughtful, and my mind started kicking up examples of thoughtlessness, I contradicted myself with, Jamie is very thoughtful, and sure enough, I was able to come up with many examples of his thoughtful behavior. Jamie doesn't enjoy celebrating holidays. Jamie does enjoy celebrating holidays. I could actually feel my opinion shift. It was almost uncanny. This effect may help explain why happy people tend to live in happier atmospheres than do less happy people. If I make positive statements, I may help persuade myself and other people to take a positive view of things. If I make negative statements, I do the opposite. For example, if I say, wow, we got so much done around the apartment today, Jamie and I are both prompted to think that we got a lot done. Make the positive argument also helped me combat my unconscious overclaiming. In unconscious overclaiming, we unconsciously overestimate our contributions or skills relative to other people. According to research, when wives and husbands estimated what percentage of housework each performed, the percentages added up to more than 120%. When I started muttering, Jamie doesn't help us get organized for trips, I argued to myself, Jamie does help us get organized for trips. And I realized, he does. Take driving lessons. In every marriage, a couple splits some responsibilities and shares some responsibilities. To a great extent, the harmony of a marriage depends a great deal on whether a couple agrees that their arrangement works out fairly. In my marriage, there was a responsibility that I felt that I ought to share, but in fact had relinquished entirely to Jamie, the responsibility of driving. Ever since I was a teenager, I'd been scared to drive. As a 15-year-old in Kansas City, I'd hated going for practice drives with my father. I'll never forget the day he calmly talked me through my panic as I drove around the dreaded Meyer Circle for the first time. I postponed taking my driver's test until I'd already been 16 for a few months, a shocking delay for a Midwesterner. When I lived in Missouri and in Washington, D.C., I did drive every day, but I was a nervous driver. Once I moved to New York City, I practically quit driving altogether. In fact, easy public transportation is one of my favorite things about living here. In New York City, having a car is a real luxury, so we're very lucky to have a car to drive. But I made Jamie do all the driving. My sister Elizabeth is the same way. She drove in Kansas City, but after she moved to New York City to go to college at Columbia, she mostly gave up driving. Even after she moved to Los Angeles, famous for its car culture, she cadged rides from her writing partner and from friends for 3 years before she started driving. I'm not a particularly fearful person. Flying doesn't bother me. I don't carry germ-fighting hand sanitizer in my bag. I don't worry about child abduction. I took the subway right after September 11th without even thinking about it. But driving. Sometimes I justify my fears with statistics. It was far more realistic to be afraid of driving than to be afraid of terrorists. Making that factually sound argument, however, wasn't a good way to rid myself of fear. I'd adjusted to my fear of driving, but I knew that it cramped my sense of freedom and possibility. For one family vacation, Jamie and I rented a little house in the country, and I worried about how I'd cope if something happened to Jamie while we were there. From time to time, I'd dream that one of the girls had been in an accident, but I couldn't jump in the car to go to her. Or I'd dream that Jamie and I were in some unfamiliar place, and he got sick, and I couldn't take him to get help. And although my fear of driving was very personal, it felt like a weight on my marriage because it loaded too much responsibility on Jamie. Anytime we had to go anywhere in a car, and even when he was feeling sleepy or needed to take a work call, he had to do all the driving. To his great credit, he never once complained about it. He never reproached me for feeling scared or not doing my share. And on the few occasions when I did drive, he was encouraging and reminded me that I was a perfectly good driver, which I was. This fear of driving had persisted for years, but it wasn't an urgent problem in No Car New York. I might never have dealt with it if it hadn't been for Sarah. Sarah is the sister of one of my close friends. Somehow she'd heard about my fear of driving, and out of nowhere she sent me a package. It was a copy of Amy Fine Collins's memoir, The God of Driving, about how Collins overcame her fear of driving with the help of an instructor, Attilo Gusso. Inside was a note. Gretchen, I thought you might find the enclosed memoir interesting. The story has been a key component of my own personal happiness project. To learn that a hyper-capable, self-reliant go-getter suffered from the same crippling fear of driving that has vexed me for years was a comfort. To then read how she fought to overcome it, despite numerous often embarrassing setbacks, was inspiring. When I saw that the very same driving teacher from the book had opened up a school around the corner, I knew it was kismet. It took months, and I had many setbacks, but I did reach the summit. I've spent the past 2 months intrepidly driving everywhere I can, navigating southern highways, picking people up at the airport, etc. I am still giddy about my accomplishment. The pride and independence I feel is beyond anything I experienced finishing the marathon or even college. Looking forward to your happiness project updates. Best regards to your whole family, Sarah. I read the note, and after procrastinating a long time, I forced myself to start The God of Driving, only to quit halfway through. It made me too uncomfortable. I was so uncomfortable, in fact, that I never even wrote to thank Sarah for the gift. It was extraordinarily rude, but I just couldn't bring myself to acknowledge it. One of my favorite Zen sayings is, "When the student is ready, the teacher will appear." In this case, the teacher appeared well before the student was ready. In the end, though, it was the memory of Sarah's description of feeling happy and free from fear that goaded me into action. When I'm reluctant to take a risk or face something uncomfortable, I ask myself the 5 fateful questions that I've pulled together over the years to help me make difficult choices. What am I waiting for? What would I do if I weren't scared? What steps would make things easier? What would I do if I had all the time and money in the world? If I were looking back at this decision 5 years from now, what will I wish I'd done? Years ago, when I was considering the intimidating switch from law to writing, I thought, I'm moving to New York, the publishing capital of the country. I have friends who are agents and writers who can give me advice. I have an idea for a book that I'm dying to write, and in fact, I've already started writing it. I really want to be a writer. What am I waiting for? Nothing. I made the switch. With driving, I thought, I have a friend who told me about her terrific driving instructor. I have the flexibility in my schedule to take lessons, and I can afford them. The driving school is in my neighborhood. There's no other major source of anxiety in my life right now. I really wish I weren't scared to drive. What am I waiting for? Nothing. I dreaded the thought of taking driving lessons, but getting over this fear would give me more freedom and make me a stronger marriage partner. Happiness doesn't always make me feel happy. As I reluctantly debated whether to add the resolution to take driving lessons to my list, I realized that the 5 fateful questions could be replaced with a single admonition. Choose the bigger life. Being willing to drive would enlarge my life. I wrote a note to Sarah. Hi, Sarah. At long last, I'm ready to tackle my fear of driving. You were so nice to send me that book so long ago, which I never acknowledged because of my own ridiculous inner psychic drama. When the student is ready, the teacher appears, and you appeared about a year before I was ready. Thank you for the encouragement. Only the recollection of your example has kept this on my mind long enough to act. Love, Gretchen. Sarah immediately responded with information and some helpful suggestions. I took a deep breath and made an appointment. I'm going to take driving lessons, I told Jamie after I'd set the first date. I want to get over this fear of driving. Really? That's terrific, he said enthusiastically. That's a great idea. Your driving is fine, you know? You just need to get back in the swing of it. Finally, the appointed hour came. For days, I dreaded that first drive, but I also felt a sense of relief. At last, I was taking a step towards solving a problem that had nagged me for so long. I steeled myself for the first lesson. I organized my day so I wouldn't feel harried or overtaxed. I triple-checked my backpack to make sure I had my driver's license, my sunglasses, and a sweater. Would I drive, or would we just talk about driving? Maybe this would be an intro class with no actual driving. At the very least, I expected that the instructor would drive me to some relatively deserted corner of New York City before putting me behind the wheel. Nope. The minute I approached Attila's double-braked car, he got out, introduced himself, shook my hand, and pointed me to the driver's seat. After a review of mirror adjustment and some basic rules of the road, I found myself driving down Lexington Avenue. I had to drive and get acquainted with Attila at the same time, which practically overloaded my system. Attila turned out to be a pleasant man with a Turkish accent and an I've-seen-it-all manner. Before too long, I found myself more at ease. I guess you get 2 kinds of students, I said. Mostly people who don't know how to drive, and some people who are scared to drive. I know how to drive, but I feel scared. That's what I want to conquer. Yes, Attila answered, you have skills. You can drive, but I can teach you how to be a better, more aware driver, a confident driver. Next time you'll drive your own car so you can get more comfortable in it. And the next week, I found myself driving up the West Side Highway in our car. Starting the lesson showed me that a big part of my problem was that every aspect of driving felt unfamiliar. I was scared of driving, true. But a lot of my uneasiness came from simple ignorance. Because I drove so rarely, I wasn't used to our car, its size, how it handled, how to turn on the defroster. I didn't know my way around the city. Because I never drove, I never learned the route to the George Washington Bridge or Midtown Tunnel. I didn't know how to use GPS. I wasn't even sure how to open the gas tank. Was it on the right or left side of the car? In every area of my life, I dislike the feeling of uncertainty or unfamiliarity. I love mastery. All these unfamiliar little tasks related to driving, not onerous in themselves, exacerbated my feelings of ineptitude and anxiety. The driving lessons forced me to refamiliarize myself with the minutiae of driving. I didn't understand any of the cryptic symbols on the car's dashboard, so I forced myself to read the manual and, dismayed by the level of detail, decided I didn't have to grasp every nuance of adjusting windshield wiper speed. I made Jamie show me how to punch an address into the GPS. I put gas in the tank. Much of this work I could have done on my own without official lessons, but I wouldn't have. I needed an outside push to help me make progress. Given the buildup from the book and from Sarah, I'd hoped that Attila would be an extraordinary figure, someone with uncanny powers. Why? Because if he had some kind of crazy charisma or some magical technique, I'd be off the hook. He'd do the work, and I'd be transformed into an enthusiastic driver. But alas, no. He was a competent driving instructor, but I would have to conquer my fear of driving on my own. After several lessons, I did start to feel more comfortable, and I actually started to drive. I drove to a store in Harlem. I drove to Randall's Island. I drove to Westchester. I was happy that I'd started driving, and I was happy to pull my weight in the driver's seat alongside Jamie. But I still wasn't a happy driver. Then one of my friends said something very helpful. "The thing is," I told her with a sigh, "I do feel less scared, but I haven't gotten rid of the dread of it. I hate to drive." "Well, you might never like to drive," she pointed out, "but that's not the same as being afraid to drive." This was a revelation. I'd expected that my driving lessons would help me to enjoy driving. After all, a lot of people love to drive. I wanted to love to drive. But maybe it wasn't in my nature to love driving. Okay, fine. I didn't have to love driving. I just had to be able to do it. The driving didn't make me happier, but successfully taking steps to conquer my fear made me very happy. As October drew to a close, Halloween scenes began to pop up in every shop window. Living in a city, I was cut off from many seasonal changes, but the cycles of stores' holiday displays, commercial, true, but still beautiful in their way, gave me a sense of continuity. Eliza and Eleanor loved to exclaim over every storefront detail, and instead of hurrying them along, I entered into the spirit of the season myself. We spent 20 minutes in front of the display at the tiny dollhouse store. The approach of Halloween meant it was time to decorate our apartment, and I felt the familiar battle in my soul. Part of me wanted to simplify my life, eliminate work, and ignore our boxes of decorations. My mother had given me part of her collection of fabulous vintage papier-mâché jack-o'-lanterns, and I needed to bring them up from the basement storage, arrange our collection of Halloween photographs of the girls through the years, and, of course, buy and carve a pumpkin. It felt daunting. But while I felt the urge to do as little as possible, I knew I was happier when I took time for projects, when I made efforts that marked the seasons. And as always, once the decorations were up, I enjoyed the festive air in our apartment. I was trying hard, with some success, to keep my October marriage resolutions, but I was discouraged by how often I broke them. Like one night when Eleanor, uncharacteristically, kept popping out of bed. "I need a drink. I fell out of bed. I had a sad thought." I stayed patient the first time, and the second, and the third. Then I told Jamie that I had to do something in my office, so he should scoop her up if she emerged yet again. Several minutes later, just as I'd become immersed in my work, I jumped when I heard my office door creak open behind me. "I can't fall asleep," Eleanor wailed. I patiently tucked her in, which required a great deal of self-mastery, then stomped into the bedroom to confront Jamie. "Thanks a lot," I said, in a voice edged with sarcasm. "You said you were going to deal with Enno. I just had to put her back to bed. I have a bunch of work I need to get done tonight, and it's already 9:30. I stomped out before letting him say a word. When I got back to my computer, I fumed as I stared at the screen. I was mad at Jamie and mad at myself. Had I been tender as I made my point? No. Had I been lighthearted? No. Well, I told myself, at least I hadn't rolled my eyes. I did a better job the next Saturday morning. Eliza was at a bowling birthday party, so Jamie and I took Eleanor to a playground in Central Park, but Jamie seemed very distracted. Do you need to go to the office? I asked. Kind of. Do you mind? He asked. No, go ahead. We'll stay here for a while. Make cheerful accommodations. Text me when you go someplace else, okay? Just so I know what you're doing. Eleanor and I kissed him goodbye, kiss, then Eleanor ran back to play. Eleanor has an impressive ability to gauge how to hang around someone, looking interested and receptive, until the time is right for an overture. Now she was hovering around a water fountain where another little girl was playing. After a few minutes, the other girl spoke up. "Want to be friends?" asked the girl, about a year older than Eleanor. "Sure. My name's Carolyn." "My name's Eleanor." They started trying to see how far they could spray the water. I took a photo and emailed it to Jamie. "Eno has a new friend. Very cute. Send an email and a photo." His message came back just a few seconds later. "What's going on? More pictures, please." If I'd reacted to Jamie's desire to go into the office by saying, "It's Saturday. Don't go into the office," I would have just made it harder for him to go into the office, and he would have gone anyway. I know him. And if I'd said, "If you go into the office now, I get to work for a few hours tomorrow afternoon," I would have behaved like the scolding scorekeeper I was trying not to be. Instead of having a pleasant interaction, we would have had an annoyed exchange. By deciding how I wanted to behave, I could shape the atmosphere of my marriage. It isn't enough to love. We must prove it. The month of November. Parenthood. Pay attention. It is impossible to win the great prizes of life without running risks, and the greatest of all prizes are those connected with the home. Theodore Roosevelt, an autobiography. Resolutions. Underreact to a problem. Enter into the interests of others. Go on Wednesday adventures. Give warm greetings and farewells. When people are asked what they want for their children, the most common answer is, "I want them to be happy." Happy children are happier, obviously. Happy children also tend to have friendlier relationships with other children, score higher on tests of creativity, and as adults, have higher work satisfaction and more social ties, and are less likely to develop emotional problems. Surprisingly, however, one University of Cambridge study found that adults who had been happy children were more likely to get divorced. Researchers haven't quite figured out why. I'd heard the saying, "You're only as happy as your least happy child." The happiness of my children matters enormously to my happiness. I want so much for them to be happy. But although I fervently want to make Eliza and Eleanor be happy, I can't. They have to figure out their happiness for themselves. Nevertheless, family members have a huge effect on each other's happiness, and I wanted to be as good an influence as I could be. Eliza, at 11 years old, was cheerful, enthusiastic, and creative. She'd taught herself to read by age 3, to the astonishment of Jamie and me, and had been reading constantly ever since. She also loved music and movies, and I think she liked having a 5-year-old sister who gave her an excuse to play multiple games of Uno, too. She spent hours taking photos and making videos, mostly of herself. She was particularly interested in anything related to advertising and would often construct campaigns for imaginary products, right down to the ad copy. Eliza was exceptionally even-tempered, and in fact, I'd learned over the years to respond swiftly to any complaint from her, because often she put up with a disagreeable situation longer than I would have wanted. She was just starting to be embarrassed by Jamie and me. At 5 years old, Eleanor easily jumped for joy, and she easily cried from frustration. Gregarious and curious, she talked to children she didn't know and entered easily into adult conversations. She was on the brink of being able to read, a step that I knew would give her tremendous pleasure. She constantly asked for someone to read to her, and she listened to audiobooks every morning and night. Perhaps as a result, she expressed herself unusually clearly for a 5-year-old, especially when she was displeased about something, and had a vast, if occasionally unreliable, vocabulary. She loved to draw and never forgot to add artful circles to represent people's knees and elbows, her signature detail. She had a limitless capacity to play by herself and would chatter and run through the apartment on invisible business by the hour. She worked hard to keep up with the interests of her big sister. Despite their 6-year age difference, the two actually played together fairly often. It still took me by surprise sometimes to realize that these two girls were my children. Was I really a mother? It seemed too huge to grasp. I'd be brushing Eliza's thick brown hair or gazing into Eleanor's blue eyes, and I'd think, holy cow, these are my daughters. As I thought about ways to cultivate a loving atmosphere at home, I reflected on my own childhood. One important element, my parents had never permitted unkind teasing in the form of mockery, name-calling, or put-downs, even when done in a joking way. At the time, I'd protested the repression of my sarcastic remarks, which I believed very witty. But looking back, I realized that this policy made for a very happy atmosphere. Teasing, as it happens, has more negative weight than many people assume. In his fascinating book, Self-Insight, David Dunning points out that teasers often don't understand how their teasing is perceived. Although the teaser believes he or she is conveying a spirit of warmth and playfulness, to the one being teased, the teasing seems more annoying and mean-spirited. True, some skillful people use teasing to help people feel closer to one another, to praise, or to broach a difficult subject. Jamie is very good at using teasing to draw the sting out of a painful situation. More commonly, however, I see people wince at teasing comments, or I hear teasers excuse rude remarks by claiming that they're just joking. But the test of whether I'm being funny is if someone else finds me funny. The test of whether my teasing is friendly is whether the teased person finds it friendly. I once overheard a loving mother say, "Hey, Nessie, are you planning to drag a brush through that rat's nest on your head?" She clearly thought this was a playful way to tell her daughter to brush her hair. But I would have been very surprised and hurt if my mother or father ever spoke to me that way. I wanted my home to have an affectionate spirit, and teasing wasn't going to play a big role. Fortunately, because I disliked that kind of talk, I'd squelched it already. To help me be the lighthearted, loving mother I aspired to be, which I knew would help Eliza and Eleanor feel lighthearted and loving, I devised 4 resolutions. The first 2 resolutions, underreact to a problem and enter into the interests of others, would remind me to stay calm and engaged. Because I loved the time I spent alone early each morning with Eleanor, I resolved to go on Wednesday adventures with Eliza to make sure I had a similar stretch of time with her. Because I knew that the way we acted toward one another would shape the way we felt about one another, for the first time, I planned to propose a resolution not just for me, but for all family members to follow. Give warm greetings and farewells. As I worked on my happiness project, I kept running up against paradoxes, and I had a paradoxical hope for my daughters. Very appropriate, given that Eliza delighted in paradoxes, like, "This sentence is false," or the line on a sheet of my bank statement that read, "This page intentionally left blank." Just as I wanted to accept myself, yet expect more from myself, I wanted Eliza and Eleanor to dream big, to have a grand vision for themselves, but also to accept themselves and to take satisfaction in small things. Underreact to a problem. Although we think we act because of the way we feel, we often feel because of the way we act. Accordingly, one of my personal commandments was to act the way I want to feel, and I'd found this fake it until you feel it strategy to be almost eerily effective. If I want to feel less anxious, I act carefree. If I want to feel more energetic, I walk faster. Along these lines, I adopted a resolution suggested by a reader who wrote from a research ship in Antarctica. Her team leader, she reported, had urged them to underreact to problems. Not to ignore or minimize problems, but just to underreact to them. And surely the problems in my apartment were more deserving of underreaction than the problems arising on a ship in the Antarctic. By underreacting to problems and acting in a serene and unflappable way, I'd help myself cultivate a calm attitude. I associated the phlegmatic sensibility and comic understatement of underreacting to a problem with the British, as when Winston Churchill remarked in 1940 on the question of a possible invasion. My technical advisors were of the opinion that the best method of dealing with a German invasion of the island of Britain was to drown as many as possible on the way over and knock the others on the head as they crawled ashore. I immediately had an opportunity to test this resolution. I was still very anxious about driving, but I was driving, and one afternoon when I was driving with Eliza, I took a wrong turn and got lost somewhere in the Bronx. The street was crowded with traffic, pedestrians, and confusing street signs. A subway track overhead added to the general chaos of the scene. How was I going to get us back? I felt a wave of panic surge over me. I felt utterly disoriented, and every minute I drove, we were farther and farther away from home. Are we lost? Eliza asked. I was reassured by her almost bored tone. Maybe a little bit, I replied distractedly. Underreact to this problem, I coached myself. Can I change the radio station? No, I answered. Actually, turn it off. I need to think. Want me to try to read the street signs for you? Yes, that's a great idea. Can you see them? Wait, I thought with longing. I can call Jamie. I had no idea what he'd be able to do. I just wanted to hear his voice. Oh, honey, I'm sorry, he said when I explained what had happened. Just remember, you're a very good driver. Don't get rattled. You sound pretty calm. Are you feeling calm? I'm actually okay. Do you know where you are? Not really. Well, I'm sorry, but I really can't help. Ask someone how to get to the Triborough Bridge. That's where you need to go. Right, the bridge. I breathed a sigh of relief. Exactly. Wish us luck. Eliza and I plowed on. Admittedly, I didn't underreact as well as I might have, but I didn't lose my head either. I tried to talk to Eliza in a casual voice. I took deep breaths. I stopped a woman on the sidewalk to ask for directions to the Triborough Bridge. I drove a few blocks, then I stopped again to ask a guy at a gas station. Once I became calmer, the problem of being lost seemed less frightening, and we made it home. I also found that underreacting to little household accidents made them less irritating, because after all, they were only as annoying as I allowed them to be. When Eliza raced into the kitchen to say, "I didn't mean to, it was an accident, I didn't see that it was there, I tried to clean it up myself, and it's not as bad as it was, but, well, a bottle of purple nail polish spilled on my carpet, it fell off a shelf and the top was off. I didn't leap to my feet to yell, why was a bottle of nail polish sitting open on a shelf? Or, you're 11 years old, don't you know how careful you need to be with nail polish? Or, why do we even own purple nail polish? Instead, I calmly went to her room, told her to look for stain removal suggestions on the internet, looked at the stain, and then spent a few minutes scrubbing it with nail polish remover. Keep working on it, I told her, and handed her the washcloth. The stain doesn't look too bad. She looked relieved that she wasn't in trouble, and I'd spared myself a session of pointless anger. No use yelling over spilt nail polish. One of the most effective ways to help myself underreact, I knew, was to joke around. Over and over, I'd found that if I acted lighthearted, I'd feel more lighthearted. This was difficult, however, because when I felt irritated, my sense of humor deserted me. One Sunday, after being fairly well-behaved all day, the girls started tormenting each other. Each of them was using all the cunning she could muster to drive the other crazy. "I'm so glad that I got a new pillow," Eleanor observed sweetly. I'm sorry you don't get one, Eliza. Well, I'm sorry you have to go to bed so early and don't get to stay up and play with me, Eliza answered with a tinkling laugh. Then the fighting started. I was in an unusually cheerful mood, so instead of snapping at them,